The following talk was given at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on February 2, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. My talk today is going to be about the teachings on equanimity and politics. I thought it might be a good opportunity for me to review my thoughts about this and my behavior, given the context of all the political discord we're currently experiencing. Likely is going to get worse as time goes on. But I'll start with a simple verse from the Therigata, which is it's a collection of gathas or verses from the 3rd century. English translation is verses of the elder nuns. And so I tried to find a little bit more history about that, but really didn't have much success. But anyway, it's a collection of very short teachings on Buddhism, obviously. This one is about the practice of equanimity. If your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend and suffering will not come your way. Again, a very simple, straightforward teaching. And I'll also start with an experience I've had actually a number of times. Maybe some of you have had a similar experience and has to do with something that might happen subsequent to sitting meditation. Of course, the deepest reason that we sit in meditation is to wake up. And that is not just about ourselves, but it's waking up to everyone and everything. I'm not suggesting I wake up when I'm sitting meditation. But sometimes, actually quite often, I'll leave the zendo with what appears to be kind of a peace of mind or a calmness, a sense of well-being. And I'll carry that with me, and in the coat room, I'll maybe have some short conversations with people and leave the building still having that sense of well-being. And I always drive here, so I get in my car, and invariably, I have the radio on, typically listening to news, and frequently that news is some political news or political ad that really disrupts my sense of well-being. And I have this period of agitation, have to remind myself to settle down a little bit. Some of you know that I'm a psychologist, and psychologists always have neat little ways to describe things. And that phenomena of flaring up and settling down is called rage to reason. And it's an overstatement of it, obviously, because very few people have experienced rage. Certainly, I don't think I ever have in my lifetime, and I know that because I've actually worked with people who do have that uncontrollable rage. But if they called it annoyance to reason, it really wouldn't have the same alliterative quality. So it's called rage to reason. And what happens during that period of agitation is that I'm thinking certainly much less than compassionate thoughts towards someone. I won't mention any names, but towards a lot of different people. So the question is, how do we develop or maintain compassion towards everyone, including those who have political views that are diametrically opposed to ours and who may be engaging in statements and behaviors that are harmful to others? You know, it's pretty easy to feel compassion towards those people who agree with us. And it's certainly easy to feel compassion towards those who are we see as victims of other people. Much more difficult to have compassion towards those who we see as being harmful to others. But again, this practice is a practice of compassion towards everybody. And I will try to talk about this in a way that makes a little bit of sense and to help us have some insight into the suffering of everyone. And I'll tell you something. This is what I remind myself of whenever I'm starting to read a book on Buddhism or studying one of the teachings, and that is that understanding comes from diligence of practice and repeat application. It takes effort. A misunderstanding comes from conceptualizing and intellectualizing the teachings. And you have to be very careful about that. You know, the teachings are not about concepts. They're about our true nature. The first part of this is really a review for most of us. Probably everybody here has read something about equanimity. They've heard talks on it. They've taken classes on it. And so you know that it's grouped together with three other teachings. Almost always it is. Then they go by various names. One of them is Four Divine Abodes, Four Sublime States of Mind, Four Noble Qualities of Mind. It's just language, just semantics. They all mean the same thing. But the term that I think or appreciate the most is when they're called the Four Immeasurables. And I think that's a term that really could apply to all the teachings. But when we think about something that's immeasurable, it means, well, obviously it can't be measured, but it really means there's no boundaries. There's no separation from other things. There's no point where one teaching ends and another begins. It's all that integrated teachings of the awakened. So these, even though I'm going to talk about it as separate, it's really not separate from any of the other teachings. These four immeasurables are sometimes described as a guide to wholesome conduct in a social situation. And I think that makes some sense. Following them really leads to a more harmonious community, kind of a social leveling, lack of distinction. And these four immeasurables, you probably know this, are loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Sometimes when you read about them or hear about them, they're described as if the first three lead to equanimity. But in fact, they are all braided together, intimately intertwined with each other, with all of the other teachings. If you practice one, you're really practicing them all. But again, we talk about that conceptually. The historical Buddha is said to have described the equanimous mind as abundant, immeasurable, without hostility or ill will. That's a pretty clear mind. Sometimes equanimity is described as a perfect, unshakable balance of mind, which is rooted in insight. And the question is, what is that insight? And the insight is that there's no barrier between yourself and anyone else. We can't have a true sense of compassion towards others if we have any kind of barrier erected. The Buddha's primary teaching were pretty simple. You know, there's suffering and relief from suffering. And everything else flows from that. He taught to look into your own suffering and into the suffering of others, and that will help you gain insight into how to behave, how to think, how to feel. It's kind of complicated, but when we do that, one of the things that we may start to notice is that our suffering is everyone's suffering, and everyone's suffering is our suffering. The conditions that manifest in any of us suffering are the same conditions that manifest for everybody else. There's really no distinction. And when we think about having compassion towards everyone, then we have to understand their suffering. We have to understand the nature of their suffering. And again, it's really not an abstract concept. Sometimes when we're reading things or talking about issues like suffering, we begin to think about it abstractly, but it's, you know, we all know it's not abstract. It's very real. It impacts all of our lives. Maybe the heart of the practice of equanimity is seeing that everyone suffers, and that allows us to respond in a wholesome way, to respond to suffering without fear or self-protection, but in a way that allows us to see our true nature, which is really to live as all beings. And all beings includes ourselves. It includes everyone we know, everyone we don't know, everyone who agrees with us, everyone who disagrees with us. Maintaining balance of mind, of course, is not easy. If it was, we wouldn't have to talk about it. When we look around, we see all kinds of things that appear to be in our imbalance. I'll just name a few: delight and despair, great joy, great sorrow, hope, fear. All of these things exist, and the practice of equanimity allows us to see it as it is, or to see it justly. And this allows us to have some peace of mind, which is really another way of saying equanimity. It allows us to experience life and emotions without unnecessary distress. And that's not to say that there isn't distress in life, because certainly there is, but there can be another way to view it where you won't have additional distress. And I think I'll talk a little bit about the misunderstandings about equanimity. Sometimes I hear it described, or maybe it's just my interpretation of how it's described, that a peaceful mind is one that doesn't experience great sorrow or great joy or despair or passion or any of those emotions, but that's really not the case. We all experience those emotions quite significantly. But with the practice of equanimity, we can have, I think, a wholehearted engagement in that without any unnecessary suffering, and in a way that can hopefully diminish the suffering, the universal suffering of everyone. The next thing I'm going to talk about is a teaching that, again, you're probably all familiar with. And it's called, by a number of different names, the five recollections, the five remembrances, the five reminders. Again, different translations have used different words, but the meanings are the same. And these are teachings that suggest we'll have a greater understanding of equanimity, a greater peace of mind from studying our true nature. These were apparently first offered in what's called, I'm going to mispronounce this, so bear with me, the Upajanhantana Sutra. And if that doesn't roll off your tongue all that easily, it's also translated as subjects for contemplation, or sometimes sutra or sutta in the field. And these are really designed to help us embrace the realities of our life, so essentially we can suffer a little bit less, appreciate our life a little bit more, and maybe help diminish sufferings of others as well. Again, you've heard these before, and the phrasings vary by translation. But they go like this. The first one is this: I am of a nature to grow old. There is no way to escape that nature. No way to escape growing old. This one's pretty straightforward, pretty easy to see. You can look in a mirror. You may notice that periodically. You look a little bit older. You may notice a photo from, a decade ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago, depending on your age. Pretty obvious that you're growing old. You may notice it in the length of time it takes you to recover from what in your past might have been a minor injury or minor illness, all manifestations of growing old. I think, unfortunately, we live in a society where growing old is not valued. We don't have the kinds of reverence or respect for elders that many other cultures do. I was thinking about it was kind of a mantra that many of us used when we were in our 20s, maybe even a little younger. It was, don't trust anyone over 30. Those of you who are my age kind of remember that being said. And of course, we turned 30 and had to quit saying it because, you know, we'd sound even more stupid. But not much reverence for growing old. Taking that into account, this is a teaching to help us grow old without any unnecessary suffering. So I am of a nature to grow old. The second one is, I am of a nature to have ill health. There is no way to escape ill health. And this one's also pretty straightforward. All of us experience some ill health. We become ill, we recover. We have serious illness, we have minor illness. Certainly we should do everything we can to take care of our health, no doubt about that. But even if we do so, we'll still become ill. The teaching is to just see that as part of our nature and not be unduly distressed by it. I am of a nature to have ill health. And the third is, I am of a nature to die. There is no escape from death. This one's a little more complicated. You know, we can live through the process of growing old. We all are. We can experience having ill health. We probably all have. It's probably fair to say none of us here have experienced death. It's kind of the great unknown. There's a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear about that. Some religions, many, actually most religions, have teachings that are comforting, such as if you live a good life, you'll go to heaven. I think some of you know my mother died about 5 weeks ago, 94 years old, very natural death. And she held that belief, that she had lived a good life and then she would be rewarded by going to heaven. There are religions that hold out that if you lead a good life, that in your next incarnation, you'll be at a higher level and closer to being able to experience spiritual awakening. I think it's important that we respect those beliefs in other people. We don't have to share them, but they provide great comfort, and I think we need to be aware of that. Probably the people I've known who are approaching death who have the most distress about it are, other than people who are young, but people who are, you know, approaching a more natural death, are those people who think that after death there's nothing. They have this idea that there's something that will become nothing. And there's no real logic or sense to that for them. It's just they believe it. But I don't think any of us are something that came from nothing. I think there was nothing. All of a sudden there was something, and then we'll be nothing again. I don't think that's our nature. But conditions arise that allow for our birth, and conditions arise that allow for our death. But it's not nothing to something to nothing. But very complicated. Causes a lot of distress. And the teaching is just to remind us that it's our nature. This will happen. Not to be unduly distressed by it. And that's the third one. I am of a nature to die. And the first three we recognize as those things that the historical Buddha as a young man noticed when he, you know, the story, he left the palace and he saw aging and illness and death, and that led him to start his journey to a spiritual awakening. The fourth one, I think, is very complicated. And this reminds us that all that is dear to me and everyone I love are of a nature to grow old, become ill, and die. There is no way to escape this nature. This is more complicated. I think we're all able to deal with our own aging, death, and dying much easier than the aging, death, or dying of our loved ones, our family, our friends, our partners. But it is a teaching on impermanence. There is no escape from that. And sometimes I've heard people say, well, if I wasn't as attached to other people, then I wouldn't experience as much distress when they die. That's a misunderstanding about attachment, I think. But in reality, it's that impermanence that makes all those relationships very special, probably more special. Because if it was a permanent relationship, it wouldn't be real. It's the impermanence. It's the specter of loss and change. As I was writing this, I remembered an incident from about 20 years ago. The Zen Dharma teacher, social activist Bernie Glassman, who died, I think, in late 2018, was giving some talks here in Twin Cities. And he was giving a talk at the, it's over in Linden Hills, that church, the spiritual center on 44th and Sheridan or Upton. Probably some of you people were there for that talk. It was well attended. He was a very engaging speaker. Shortly before, or sometime in the months before he gave the talk, his wife had died. And this was well known. I don't remember if he mentioned it, but I knew that many people knew this. And I remember almost nothing about the talk, actually. It was 20 years ago. I'm sure it was wonderful because he's a very engaging speaker. But I do remember that something happened after the talk. As with all Dharma talks or talks of that kind, there's always a period for questions and answers and comments. And so there was one, I think, a young man then who asked Bernie Glassman Roshi if he would describe how his Buddhist practice prevented him from feeling grief and sorrow at the death of his wife. I had one of those little rage to reason moments there, because I just remember being kind of stunned by that question, that someone would ask somebody that in that context. And, you know, I would have liked to have lectured the young man on proprieties of questions, but of course I didn't have the opportunity. And then as I was thinking about it this week when I was writing this talk, and I thought, well, you know, I wasn't being very compassionate. I didn't understand that this young man had some kind of misery or suffering that was prompting that question. Either, you know, maybe truly didn't understand. Maybe had just dramatic misunderstandings about the nature of Buddhist practice. Maybe he didn't have much social grace. But whatever it was, I was not being compassionate. So it was one of those rage to reason moments that actually only took about 20 years. So better late than never, right? But that's that kind of thing. Something happens and we respond based on all kinds of reasons. And they're less than compassionate. But if we take a little time, we may realize, you know, the other person is suffering. That's the fourth reminder or recollection. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of a nature to grow old, to become ill and die. And the fifth one, it's a little simpler in some ways. And it goes like this. My karma is my only true possession. I cannot escape the consequences of my karma. Now, you could say, instead of karma, because that's a term that's a lot of times misunderstood, my thoughts and my actions, my intentions are my only true possessions. I cannot escape the consequence of my thought, my intention, my actions. And this fifth reminder, just a simple reflection on our true nature. And it, I think, it kind of unfolds in all of the teachings of the Buddha Dharma. You know, think of the Eightfold Path or the precepts, all those kind of things are reflections on your intentional behavior. So that's the five remembrances, and I think can be very helpful for us in understanding our suffering, but also to be more compassionate towards the suffering of others. And I'm going to talk just a little bit about religion. Obviously, religion and politics historically have been intertwined. The initial governing bodies in most societies were religiously based, and you know that had carried through. We can think of the the European governing system with kings and queens, with even emerging something called the divine right of kings, that they had some godly demeanor about them. But and we understand that, it's part of the history we know. But I think that part of religion that probably has most impact on us, on either conscious or unconscious level, is early training that we had. It's probably safe to say that everyone here came from one of the Abrahamic religions, meaning you grew up in either a primarily Christian here, I think, but a Christian, Muslim, or Jewish community. And they all have some, they all have the same roots, right? They're all religions that come from the God of Abraham. And one of those stories that they all share is the one about the tree of knowledge, or the tree of good and evil. All of those religions share that story, and I think it sets the stage for life to be kind of divided or bifurcated into good or evil. And I won't really review the story much other than to say that, you know, in the story, mankind really didn't have to deal with good and evil, and then they were exposed to it, and things went downhill from there. And that really, I think, sticks in the backs of many people's minds, it really sets the stage for, you know, a source of some extreme views. You know, for those who are prone to that kind of thinking, it seems natural to see things as being either good or evil. But it's not really true of all religions or spiritual practices, as you know. It's not a theme you'll find in Hinduism or Buddhism or Taoism. You don't really see teachings on those kinds of extreme thoughts. We certainly don't see it in those religions that I think sometimes are dismissively referred to as primitive religions, meaning the spiritual practices of indigenous people. I have a lot of interest and actually have done quite a bit of study on indigenous spiritual practices in North America, but there's similar ones in other parts of the world. And what you'll notice when you even slightly step into studying those practices is there is really a reverence for the spirit of everything. Everything is respected. The spirit of inanimate objects, the spirit of the earth, the spirit of animals, the spirit of people, including the spirit of your enemy. There's reverence towards each thing, which I think is a very meaningful and to me very refreshing approach, certainly different than the society we're currently living in, a society in this country where there's not much reverence towards anything, certainly not towards people, not towards the environment, not towards the earth. It'd be nice if we could go back to some of that. But I only mention these things about religion because if we're not thoughtful about it, there's a greater risk that we may be drawn into some of that good versus evil thinking that came from our religious training, our root religion in that culture. I'm going to just tell or recite two little stories, teachings from various people on how not to get caught up in divisive political and religious thinking. And the first one is, you're familiar with both of these people. The first one is a story about the great soul of India, the Mahatma, Mohandas Gandhi, who very famously led the civil action to end the brutal British colonial rule of the Indian subcontinent, which is bigger than India, right? It's what we now think of Pakistan and Sri Lanka. All of that was controlled by the British. He did that in a way that was a little, was unique certainly to people in our country, but he followed the practice of nonviolence, which in Hindu and some Buddhist sects is called Ahimsa, doing no injury, no harm. Some of the things that came from that, one of them would be a vegetarian diet that's very prevalent in Hindu culture and in some Buddhist cultures. He had the idea that you would see, the Hindu teaching on that, and actually the Buddhist teaching as well, is that deeper truths become evident to you when you're not engaging in violent behavior. And there are some Christian denominations that have a very similar approach. Of course, Gandhi lived and died before any of us were born. At least I don't think anyone was here is of that age. If you are, I'll have some reverence for you. But we all did live, and some of us were of an age where we lived it very intently. The civil rights movement in this country led by Martin Luther King Jr. And as you know, Dr. King modeled his approach on that of Gandhi, on the nonviolent approach to civil action. And that was, again, while nonviolence was not a unique phenomena in the Indian subcontinent, particularly among Hindus, nonviolence was a dramatic departure from the culture here. Not many people, very few people understood nonviolence. Probably only the people who, in this country, who, well, maybe they were of a Hindu faith that followed that, or maybe they were some of the Christian religions. I think of Amish, for example, who followed that very, very intently. So Dr. King had to do a lot of teaching to his followers. And he was famously known for making this statement. Nonviolence means avoiding not only external physical action, but also violence of spirit. We must have nonviolence in our hearts and our minds, which and a very, very clear understanding or teaching of compassion. But back to Gandhi. So anyway, one of the, I'll use the pejorative term of manipulations that the British used to try to maintain control over India was to say that if the, parentheses, good Christians, the British, left, then the Hindus and the Muslims would kill each other. And so that's why they needed to stay. There's lots of reasons they needed to stay, and even though there was a sliver of truth in that, that there would be conflict between Hindus and Muslims. Primarily they were staying in an effort to continue the status quo of taking all the riches from India. And so they would approach Gandhi with this, trying to get him to give up his mission of kicking the British out of India. And they would say, oh, you know, if we leave, this horrible thing is going to happen. And his response, apparently, reportedly always the same. He would say something along these lines. Christians, Hindus, and Muslims, aren't we all children of God? Shouldn't we behave as such? And going beyond those religious divisions, and I think really speaking in a compassionate way and following the practice of equanimity. Unfortunately, you know, when the British left, there was a lot of violence, but Gandhi was responding to his own philosophy. The other teaching came from the Dharma teacher, Suzuki Roshi. Many of you are familiar with him, of course. And I read this a long time ago, and I it was his response to a question, and I never could find, you know, what had preceded the question or what followed it, whether there's any discussion. And unfortunately, that's what happens with a lot of things. You see a little quote from, you know, this or that Zen teacher, but it doesn't really give you the context. Well, This was his response to a question or someone asking him to describe the difference between Buddhism and other religions. It's a fair question. His response was, when we really understand the teachings of Buddhism, we see that we are all Buddhist, which I think was a very clear teaching to his followers, to people who try to follow the middle way. On the surface, you can say, well, no, a Catholic's not a Buddhist, but what he was really talking about is our true nature. We all have Buddha nature. Everyone has Buddha nature, whether you call yourself a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu. We all have Buddha nature. And if we are going to feel compassion and act in a compassionate manner towards everyone, we need to see that. We don't want to get caught up in the fact that one group of people, whether it's religious or political, are subjects of our compassion, others are not. It's a universal thing. You know, we are all children of God, we are all Buddhist. And if we, regardless of how your viewpoint on that, if we take that tactic, then we're much less likely to engage in things that cause us and other people to have more suffering. So let me talk just a little bit about politics. I won't really support or talk against any political parties in this talk, of course. But I'm going to talk about equanimity in our approach to politics. Now, one of the things that we all know is that in terms of the political turmoil and the discourse, it's getting worse. And it has been getting worse over the recent past. And unfortunately, I think it will continue to get worse. One of the things that you may have noticed very strongly during the 2016 presidential election was the sociological phenomena that is known as negative polarization, which is, and I'm not one prone to conspiracy theories, but it really is digging into that things are good or evil, very differentiated between the two, not much room for middle ground, draws on divisiveness. Can be quite appealing to some people, but how it really works is, in its basic sense, and you never hear it this way, is, you know, you may really hate me, but you hate my opponent even more. Now, I haven't heard a politician say, you really hate me, though I have heard them say, you hate my opponent. But what it really is saying is, it's us versus them. And it's said through insinuation and intimidation. It's said through dog whistles and all the other kinds of things. And what it, from a political perspective, it's designed to have things be on the extremes, that you hold one extreme view or the other, and that those people then control what happens. And there's not much in the middle, because if you follow that sociological phenomena, those people in the middle don't want to participate, and they don't. A good example in that election was, as you probably know, there were more registered voters who did not vote than voted for either one of the major party political candidates. There was a lot of success in that. I think we have to be aware of that and make sure that if we want to practice with compassion, that we don't get caught up in those extreme views. And as I said, those extreme views a lot of times have kind of a moral or a good versus evil basis to them. Again, the practice of equanimity allows us to see the suffering in everybody. Those we agree with, those we disagree with. Those who promote kind of that negative polarization, those who don't. By the way, there really isn't such a thing as positive polarization. You really don't hear someone say, you know, my opponent is just this great human being, lovely person, wonderful person, but I'm a little more wonderful, so you should vote for me. That doesn't work. It doesn't appeal to the same basic negativity that we might have. And all of that politics that I just talked about is caught up in that us versus them and personalities and all the things that we hear about. But when we think about the practice of compassion or equanimity, it applies to other sociological and political things as well. And I think sometimes there's some real misunderstanding about where peace of mind or sense of equanimity comes from. You know, I do sometimes hear people say, I'm not going to participate in the conflict or the discrepancy between the powerful and the powerless. But in fact, if you take that approach, that's not the practice of equanimity, that's siding with the powerful. This is really not a soapbox, but I'll get somewhere with this. Or you might hear someone say, I won't side with or take sides in the difference between the extremely rich and the impoverished, but that's essentially siding with the extremely rich. And we can throw other categories in, you know, those who have lives of extreme privilege and those who live in abject discrimination. Or you don't take sides between the excessively wealthy and the people who live in mansions and those who are homeless. Not taking sides is really not the practice of equanimity. You know, it'd be pretty easy to say, well, of course, I'll take sides with the powerless, right, or the homeless, or the discriminated against, but that really isn't the practice either. It's somehow understanding how to side with everyone, have compassion towards everyone, understand the sufferings of everyone. It's a pretty complicated thing to do when you think just subjectively, you know, how do you understand the suffering of someone who lives in a mansion and has a life of privilege? It requires some effort and some thought. But the truth is that the cause of their suffering is the same as the cause of your suffering. Now, when you take action based on that, your action might be more wholesome. It might be action that will allow everyone to have a little bit diminished suffering. It's not easy to find what that action is. At least for me, it's certainly not. When we, just look to the example of the Buddha, he didn't discriminate among the people he gave his teachings to. Right. He taught to the untouchables, he taught to the Brahmin and all those segregated societal divisions in between. No distinction. Same teachings to everybody. In a sense, I think we can have the same compassion towards everybody. It's just easier to be compassionate towards some people than others, but not impossible. So then the question, you know, what do you do with the understanding that everyone suffers, that your suffering is everybody's suffering? Well, certainly the teachings of the awakened will guide you. It requires a lot of diligence, but I have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to really offer one suggestion, and that is just to be very thoughtful about what you say and how you say it. If we look at the bigger picture of the political discord, if everyone was thoughtful about what they said, it wouldn't be happening. I mean, there'd still be problems, there still would be divisions, but it wouldn't be as significant. And it's important for us to think about what we say, not only about people, but to people. Not only what we say with our close friends, but what other things we say in public. And what I'll offer as one practice that might be helpful is a teaching actually comes from the Sufi Muslims. We know them best as, you know, those, they wrote that wonderful religious poetry teachings in the 11th, 12th, 13th century, like we think of Hafiz or Rumi or McGrivery, any of those, you know, wonderful poets that we call romantic poets or wrote about the relationship between man and Allah. But they had a lot of very down-to-earth kind of teachings, and this is a teaching called The Three Gates. And actually, you know, when I was still working as a psychologist, I mainly worked with children and families, and I used this teaching in my work. A lot of high conflict families. And, you know, the first thing one needs to do in a high conflict situation is de-escalate, right? That's in every high conflict situation. That is the first thing you do. Otherwise, nothing ever works out. And I would teach this to the families, although I didn't actually use, I didn't say it was a Sufi practice because that would have complicated it. I don't think I ever saw any Sufi Islam people in my practice. So anyway, here's the three gates, very simple. At the first gate, you stop and you have to decide if the thing you want to say is the truth as you know it. That eliminates lots of things, right? There's a lot of things that we want to say that may not actually be the truth as we know it. But if it's the truth as you know it, you pass to the second gate. And at the second gate, you get to contemplate on whether the truth as you know it is necessary to say. That filters out, again, a whole bunch of things, right? But if it's the truth as you know it, and necessary to say, you go to the third gate, and at the third gate, you have to decide if you can say it with love and kindness. And if you can, feel free to speak. Otherwise, just be quiet. And it is a thoughtful way to diminish the conflict. One of the things that frequently families would say is, well, it won't work unless everybody does it. That's not the case. Usually in any family I was working with, there would be one, maybe two people who would follow that practice. It had a dramatic impact on everybody else. If one person is thoughtful in what they say, one person is mindful about things that cause conflict, then everyone benefits. In the sense, when we're thoughtful about it, it certainly can benefit us and benefit others. So with that, I'm just going to stop, and there's a few minutes if anyone has any questions or comments. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.